Hello, podcasters, and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts, we explore different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. In the first part of this podcast, we examined what way the Civil War split began to fall in Kilkenny in the spring of 1922. We saw how the Free State authorities in Kilkenny were not going to be pushed around, which led to an escalation in the tensions. This led to full-scale urban warfare as Free State troops tried to dislodge anti-treaty troops from different buildings around the city. In just one day though, Commandant Prout managed to dislodge the anti-treaty forces from all but one of their recently acquired buildings, the last one being of course Kilkenny Castle. So day two of the Battle of Kilkenny, which was May the 3rd, 1922, it was a Wednesday, began much the same as the previous day had concluded, with the anxious citizens of Kilkenny awoken by a morning course of gunfire. Proceedings really got underway just after 10 a.m. when Commandant Prout left the military barracks to resume his command in the Bank of Ireland on the parade at the left bank. At all times, Prout's 12-year-old son, Jack, was by his side. Jack was no stranger to shooting a gun and carried two Webley revolvers with him. It was commented upon at the time that he had just as good a shot as his father. Now, Free State soldiers took every available vantage point around the city to attack the castle. But the siege of Kilkenny Castle, the first such event in many a century, was going to take longer than the relatively swift operation of the previous day. Sniping and machine gun fire from the Free State Army was unrelenting throughout the day. By this stage, most of the windows on the outer walls of the large castle had been broken by gunfire. Now in the early afternoon, a group of Free State reinforcements who were travelling to the scene of the action from the military barracks had a miraculous escape. As they were proceeding over John's Bridge in an uncovered lorry, there was a burst of machine gun fire aimed at them from the castle. In what was a minor miracle, the machine gun trajectory had been set slightly too high, and the only damage it did was to knock the caps from the heads of the tallest soldiers. There were some other crazy stories from the day too. As High Street was closed to traffic and schools were closed for obvious reasons, a group of young boys played a hurling match outside a tollstall. The novelty of playing a game on the main thoroughfare was too good an opportunity to resist, never mind that a gun battle was raging just down the other end of the street. Also, the pension man who delivered British Army pensions at the beginning of the month for the First World War veterans of Kilkenny also managed to get through the barricades to do his rounds. The relief of seeing him on High Street permitted one man to exclaim loudly, "We're all right, as long as he's not killed." Now going back to the castle, the first ground assault on the occupied castle took place. Several Free State machine guns were directed at the castle and fired simultaneously to subdue the anti-treaty men inside. Five Free State soldiers made their way up the parade under the cover of the wall of the castle gardens. They then ran to the large wooden entrance of the castle and began hacking the lock and the wooden panels trying to get in. They eventually got inside the courtyard but were immediately met with machine gun fire from the anti-treaty men inside the courtyard. Sergeant Fennelly and Cadet James Kennedy were hit in the shoulder and leg respectively. The party then retreated and the injured were brought to the military barracks hospital. At about 4:30 p.m. there was a second ground attack on the castle. A number of Free State soldiers advanced to the main entrance, kind of hiding behind an armoured car for protection. The vehicle also had a machine gun attached and this was firing at the anti-treaty positions. Upon getting close to the castle, as the battle raged around them, the three Free State soldiers crawled along the ground towards the large wooden doors. As one of the party was about to raise his arm to throw a grenade at the entrance, he was hit by a rifle bullet. The Free State party then retreated, bringing their injured comrade with them. Later that evening, it became apparent to the attacking Free State forces that ammunition inside the castle was running low, as the amount of gunfire returned from the anti-treaty IRA inside had reduced dramatically. Then at 8:45 p.m, a large group of Free State troops charged up the streets, led by an armoured car under the command of Captain Flood. As one journalist later described it, a veritable sprout of lead was directed against a huge lock on the main gate of the castle, and in a few minutes it was smashed. The armoured car then crashed through the entrance gates and into the inside courtyard of Kilkenny Castle. Free State reinforcements followed in behind, and they were led by Captain Leonard. There was a brief exchange of gunfire, but the anti-treaty IRA eventually surrendered after about 50 minutes, having fought a battle that had lasted nearly 12 hours that day. As the gunfire ceased, large crowds began to congregate near the parade to see for themselves what had occurred. The anti-treaty IRA were escorted from the castle by Free State soldiers. To everyone's surprise, only 15 anti-treaty IRA men were led away. Now, it is more than likely many anti-treaty escaped through the parklands at the back of the castle during the day or in the evening before the final attack. Indeed, we do know that Martin Bates of the Roar had been sent to the battle by his commander John Welch of the 5th Battalion, Greg Namana. Bates stated that he had travelled to Kilkenny along with a column of 38 men from that part of the county to take part in the fight. He said that after fighting all day, he got away around 4 p.m. over a wall, bringing the whole 38 with me, and so they avoided being captured. Indeed, it was no use from an anti-treaty viewpoint of them all getting arrested, and a core group of 15 were likely chosen to stay back and defend the castle. And we know that on the first day when the anti-treaty arrived, the caretaker believed 22 men had initially took over the castle. Ned Elward, the anti-treaty commander, was nowhere to be found, although there had been rumours he was seen in Kilkenny the day before. All 15 arrested men inside the castle were from County Kilkenny. They hailed from 7 different parishes. The officer commanding of the anti-treaty forces in the castle was Richard Dick Brennan of Knockanure, Munkine. He was on the brigade staff of the 9th Battalion down in Munkine. He had taken part in the Sidnitz Cross ambush down there just the previous June. Brennan believed they would have lasted much longer in the castle if they had more ammunition. He had in fact been badly injured in the hand, either by a bullet or splinters caused by a bullet. During the heavy gunfire that day, Hannah Dooley, later Murphy, who was the Cumann na Mban leader in Kilkenny, entered the castle to give him first aid. She also brought ammunition with her from other garrisons. Now, the list of 15 men arrested gives a good sense of the geographical spread of the men. They were Thomas Nipper Nolan of Magdalen Street, Kilkenny, James Wall of Lord Edward Street, Kilkenny, James Legger Mar, Patrick Street, James Duffer Morrissey, Abbey Street, Edward Kyogan, Patrick Street, David Dowling, Magdalen Street, Patrick Welch from Ballykeith, Kilmana, Richard Dick Brennan, the OC, as we said, from Munkine, Edward Ned Dunphy from Carrageen, John Foskin, River Quarter, Munkine, and Patrick Welch of Clogher, Munkine. Then from Kilmacow came John Welch and Michael Hallahan. There was Michael Phelan from Dunmore, Ballyfoyle, and Dan O'Neill was from Blanchfields Park, Clifton. Now all 15 anti-treaty men shook the hand of Lord Ossory before they left as a mark of respect and of no ill feeling. The Kilkenny Journal later described the scenes on the parade as such, quote, "Everyone was confident the number of IRA men was large. Judge then the amazement of the huge gathering assembled on the parade when just 15 prisoners were marched out between two single files of armed GHQ, that's Free State troops. As the gallant defenders of the castle turned into rows in streets, cheers were given and portions of the crowd expressed their admiration with shouts of, 'Up the Republic!'" End quote. Next to leave the castle was Lord Ossory himself, who received an equally enthusiastic cheer from the amassed crowd. Lord Ossory spoke in complimentary terms about his IRA visitors, stating, "They were courtesy itself and fought with much bravery. I had permission to leave the castle if I chose to do so, and was also guaranteed a safe escort. However, he decided not to vacate his home, as it would look like we were flunking it." He went on to say, "They," that's the IRA, "did not go into any room that was not necessary for their military purposes, and they obtained their own food. To recover from the ordeal, both himself and his wife were going to take some time to holiday in England," commenting, "I have been through the European War," that's the First World War, "and did not mind it, but Lady Ossory has not had that experience and her nerves are somewhat upset. We have been here for 700 years and we are going to stay here. Now, not to be forgotten, there was also 10 servants in the castle during the battle as well. Some of these would permanently have been based there and would have been locals. Others would have travelled from England with the couple when they were staying in Kilkenny. They all took cover in the cellars of the castle for most of the fighting. Now, another is a view that it was lucky the castle was not burnt down by the anti-treaty IRA that day, and that was the reason Lord Ossory stayed inside the whole time. But I don't think that is the case. This was May 1922, not May 1923. I suppose what I mean by that is that if the same event had occurred later in the conflict, the castle could easily have been sensitized in a situation like this. The main reason this was done was to stop the Free State forces from taking over one of the anti-treaty's former garrisons. For instance, Woodstock House was burnt down for this purpose. But the anti-treaty IRA had not started their campaign of strategic destruction at this stage, or their campaign of destruction for political reasons. For instance, the big houses of Oireachtas senators and TDs, such as Desert Hall, which was burnt down in Kilkenny. They hadn't burnt down other occupied buildings they held in Kilkenny or indeed elsewhere at this particular point in time. Indeed, at this period in May 1922, they were still trying to put forward the view that they were the most noble in their intentions and the true defenders of the Republic. The dirtier parts of the Civil War were still months away, but the Free State Army weren't going to take any chances. To be on the safe side, they set up a full-time military posting at the castle. Soldiers would be there 24/7 for the duration of the Civil War, and actually right up until September 1923. That's 16 months after the events in question here. Many a Kilkenny native who was in the Free State Army had memories of spending time there, and this was a time we must remember when most Kilkenny folk had never set foot inside the grounds of the castle. Luckily for us, with the help of the OPW, we still get to admire the beauty of the castle today. Now, going back to Lord Ossory after the anti-treaty had been removed from his home, it is likely he was less upbeat than his initial reaction suggested once he surveyed all the damage. The cost of this damage to the castle and its furnishings was estimated to be £3,310, which would be the equivalent of around 240,000 to €250,000 today. The compensation application was made on his behalf by his land agent, Thomas Richard Sieg, steward and land agent for Lord Ossory. It was meticulous in its costing of each pane of glass, each wooden panel that had been riddled with bullet holes, and also how much replastering of individual walls would cost to repair, not to mention the paintings and other damages. The largest estimated cost of damage was to the oak bedroom, now likely known as the tapestry room, with a repair cost of £273.07. This room is located at the tower facing the River Nore and would have borne the brunt of the fighting from John's Bridge and beyond. A sniper battle even took place in this position from the married quarters of the military barracks to the tower, a fair distance it must be said. The damage to the dining room of the castle, which faced onto the rose garden and has all those lovely bay windows, was estimated to be £218.15. In the end, the Free State government acceded to the compensation request nearly in its entirety, paying out £3,250. That's just £60 short. This contrasts greatly to other claims, usually from those further down the social ladder, which had the amounts paid out downgraded by the Free State government. But it could also mean that Lord Ossory's claim was a fair one and not overestimated. At the start of the fighting, the anti-treaty IRA had allowed Lord Ossory to move his family's most valuable possessions to the vaults of the local banks in Kilkenny, likely some jewellery, money and deeds, etc., where they were kept safe. Now again, this was a way the anti-treaty could show they weren't interested in stealing or losing. They weren't common thieves. Ossory described events of the 2 days to a journalist, which was reported as follows. Quote, "The executive, that's the anti-treaty, forces entered that Monday night very quietly and told the night's lodgeman that nobody was to be disturbed. Lord Ossory did not learn of their presence in the castle until about 7 o'clock on Tuesday morning. Lady Austrey and he had breakfast in his sitting room in the wing facing the parade that morning and remained there all during the day until 4 o'clock. This was because the parade wing was deemed to be the safest as not in the direct line of fire. Lord Austrey went on to say, "We had no food at that time, and during the lull in the firing, we dodged along the corridor between the windows until we got to another quarter of the castle. The sitting room mentioned is one of the 4 rooms not damaged by the firing. Practically all the bedrooms and sitting rooms are now uninhabitable. All the windows are shattered and chunks of plaster and glass are strewn all around. Practically all the bookcases were pierced with bullets. In one panel alone, I counted 20 bullet holes. In all, nearly a dozen paintings were pierced with single bullet holes. Practically all rooms will need repairs of one sort or another." End quote. Now, as you probably know, the castle has been extensively renovated since then, but if you are doing a tour, there are bullet holes still to be seen in the tapestry room of the castle, so keep an eye out for that. Now, the day after the castle had been evacuated, Lord Ossory invited Prout to breakfast with himself and his wife, an invitation he greatly accepted. The press took a picture of the three of them in the courtyard of the castle grounds. It is also likely that on that same day, the famous picture was taken which reenacted the attack on the castle, and I used it for the cover of my book. Although not exactly authentic as it was a stage photograph, it is nonetheless contemporary, happening only 24 hours after the events, and it does give a good idea of how the Free State soldiers attacked the castle in the first charges. The broken gates and the broken windows of the castle can even be seen in the photograph. Now back to that Wednesday evening on the 3rd of May. Following the surrender of the castle, the anti-treaty IRA garrison in the Parliament Street RIC station also surrendered. They had been in possession of that barracks for over 2 weeks at this stage. In addition, 3 members of Kilkenny Cumann na Mban, Maisie Salar, Talla Dooley and Oona Egan, who were acting as dispatch and ammunition carriers for the anti-treaty forces, were arrested on High Street while in possession of a revolver. They were all released once the fighting had ceased. Another Cumann na Mban member, Nellie Hine of Wolf Tone Street, had her home raided on several occasions by Free State soldiers as they thought she'd be holding either anti-treaty IRA soldiers or ammo. She was not involved in this particular conflict, however, as she was attending to her elderly father who was dying. So in total, 108 anti-treaty IRA members were captured in Kilkenny over the course of the 2-day altercation. Now, it is possible that up to double that number escaped. When you think about it, the forecourt in Dublin was defended by about 200 anti-treaty men in June 1922. The numbers in Kilkenny then would have been very similar. For those anti-treaty trying to avoid capture, it wouldn't have been too difficult to do, as the Free State did not have the resources to cordon or surround the whole city to prevent it from happening. And it was no use in all the anti-treaty getting arrested either. They did not know how long they were going to be in prison for, and they would have been of better use outside prison walls if a full-scale civil war was to break out. All 108 men arrested were incarcerated in Kilkenny military barracks, mostly confined to the barracks chapel, which of course is still there today and looks the exact same. Overall, 18 people were reported as having been physically wounded during the fighting in the city, with 14 of the total classified as slight wounds to the arms or legs, with the remainder described as serious wounds. The Free State casualties numbered 12 of the total, most having received their injuries during the 2 failed ground assaults on the castle. And just to be clear, these were casualties, not fatalities. Newspaper headlines the day after gave a figure of 18 fatalities. This would appear to have been a misunderstanding by Sean O'Hegarty, OC of the Cork No. 1 Brigade, when he happened to be giving an update to the Dáil on Wednesday the 3rd of May, the exact same day as the attack was happening on the castle. He quoted an army report stating in the Dáil that, "I have reports that there is heavy fighting going on in Kilkenny and that 18 people have been killed," end quote. It's possible either himself or whoever compiled the report thought the casualty figure was the fatality figure. Now, the vast majority of the Free State soldiers injured in Kilkenny were natives of Dublin City, and they were part of the reinforcements that arrived on the Tuesday afternoon. This is not surprising, as the earliest recruits to the Free State Army were in the Dublin Guard. Some of these were former IRA, and Collins's closeness to the IRA command in Dublin during the War of Independence meant many went Free State during the Civil War, much more in the Munster area. Another significant portion of them would have had training in the British Army and fought in the First World War. The Free State authorities sent out the following list of those injured: Private John Burke, Rathfarnham; Private Con Riley, Gardner Street; Private Lee Daly, Mary Lane; Private J.J. Cavanagh, Bride Street; Private Michael O'Neill, 17 Robert Street, who was classified as seriously wounded; Private Patrick Keogh, James Street; Private Thomas Morris, 14 Charlemont Mall; Private Dan Conroy, 2 Mile Boris, Tipperary. Also with no addresses given were Private John Martin, Private Thomas Young, Sergeant Fenley, who was described as seriously wounded, and James Kennedy, also described as seriously wounded. We know some, such as Michael O'Neill from Dublin, who received a gunshot wound to the heel of his foot, were former IRA men during the War of Independence. O'Neill had only enlisted in the Free State Army 3 weeks before, on the 10th of April. Also, J.J. Cavanagh, another of those injured on the streets of Kilkenny, had been imprisoned for his IRA activities during the War of Independence and had taken part in the 1916 rebellion as an Athenia scout, as he was too young to fight. In the other camp, 4 anti-treaty IRA men were recorded as having received wounds, although they were much likely to have been more. Besides Margaret Lockman, the only other civilian injury reported was, quote, a young boy named Kavanagh, end quote, who received a ricochet bullet wound to his foot when he was playing hurling near the Fair Green on Wednesday evening. Overall, Prowse had moved swiftly and efficiently. He was likely very happy with his Free State charges. They had cleared the anti-treaty forces from all the buildings they held in Kilkenny within just 2 days. However, to stop any tensions escalating further, immediately there were something like peace talks held. This happened the following morning, Thursday the 4th of May, not in Kilkenny, but in Dublin, in the Mansion House. Leading representatives of both the Free State and anti-treaty factions, 6 representing each side, came together with the aim of coming to some form of arrangement that would calm the situation. The delegation included Liam Lynch and Liam Mellows on the anti-treaty side and Ono Duffy on the Free State side, who a few months later would be enemies. And of course, Lynch and Mellows would die during the Civil War. The group wanted to avoid a replication of events that had engulfed Kilkenny the previous days from spreading to other areas of the country. In addition, they sought to reach an agreement on the fate of the anti-treaty IRA prisoners in Kilkenny military barracks. They needed a peace deal, and fast, as back in Kilkenny, Commandant Prout was not yet finished with the fighting. The battle had now moved to rural parts of County Kilkenny. In tandem with their comrades in Kilkenny City, on Tuesday the 2nd of May, 12 members of the anti-treaty IRA had taken over the vacant RSE barracks in Gorn, along with the adjoining courthouse. The Free State forces, under the command of Captain Joyce, attacked the building early on Thursday morning. The anti-treaty IRA inside responded, and a gun battle broke out. After about 20 minutes, the Free State forces stormed the building and arrested the men. They also captured 10 rifles, some grenades and gel ignite. Aside from Gorin, the Free State authorities had a matter of even greater concern in the southwest of the county. Nearly 500 anti-treaty IRA soldiers under the command of 33-year-old Dinny Lacey from Attybrick, County Tipperary, had mustered around the town of Callan. They were made up of a good many Kilkenny and Tipperary fellows, and likely from even further afield from Limerick and even Cork. Some no doubt had escaped down there from the Battle of Kilkenny, but Kilkenny and South Tip were in the 2nd Southern Division, thus they were all part of the same overall command structure. Actually, East Limerick was also in that division, and it would not be unusual for the anti-treaty to move around the division as the Civil War progressed. Indeed, Kilkenny anti-treaty IRA men found themselves in Limerick City 2 months previously, when there was a standoff there between pro and anti-treaty factions into who would control the barracks. Just to remind you, Callan, by the way, was the native parish of Na Delwart, anti-treaty IRA leader in Kilkenny. He was now back in Callan and in command of the Kilkenny contingent mustering in the town there. They were also joined by Seamus Robinson, later OC of the entire 2nd Southern Division anti-treaty IRA and native of Belfast and of course of Solohead Beg fame. So he would kind of outrank Ned when he was around. They gathered in Callan with the objective of helping their comrades who were under siege in Kilkenny City. To pay for provisions, they took a considerable sum of money from the Callan branch of Bank of Ireland, with the bank teller commenting that they were as courteous as possible under the circumstances. A receipt for the amount taken from the branch was charged to the IRA Army Executive. The Army Executive had given orders nationally for anti-treaty men to take money from certain banks to pay for provisions, etc. The local parish priest was not best pleased with the new arrivals, however. Bill Quirk from Tipperary, who was an anti-treaty brigade officer, described an altercation he had with a priest. A party of anti-treaty men were in the act of dismantling walls and using some of the stone to build barricades on the road into Callan town and out of Callan town to impede any Crown forces that may arrive. Quirk said, quote, "The local priest in Callan kicked up a row over the building of the wall and Elward had it removed in consequence. I ordered them to replace it. The priest asked me who was responsible for building the wall. I told him I was. He said, did I not know that the wall was the property of the people of Callan? I told him he was there to look after their spiritual welfare while I was there to look after their corporal welfare, and derived my authority from the Irish Republican Brotherhood General Headquarters." End quote. Indeed, while the battle had been raging around Kilkenny Castle on Wednesday the 3rd of May, Captain Leonard travelled towards the Callan area in a convoy of armoured motor cars to cut off any anti-treaty reinforcements that may have been on their way to Kilkenny. They stumbled upon the main anti-treaty IRA column, including the column leader Seamus Robinson, Denny Lacey and Bill Quirk, erecting a barricade on the roadside just outside Cuff's Grange on the road to Callan. The Free State soldiers immediately opened fire with their machine gun on the anti-treaty men, who scattered in every direction. A number of the men were wounded, 7 seriously wounded, with Quirk later remarking, quote, "It was miraculous no one was killed," end quote. Indeed, it could have been a lot worse but for Cumann na Mban member Maisie Barris ní Gaffney, who spotted the oncoming Free State cavalcade and signalled down to the anti-treaty men who were eating and having some refreshments in a field beside the road. This saved them some valuable seconds and the men were able to take cover behind the wall and set up a machine gun post. Maisie was scouting for the IRA in the belfry of the Catholic Church in Cuff's Grange, that's still there today, alongside IRA volunteer Sean Darmody. In another part of the county, the Free State forces in Woodstock House and in Inistig were attacked by the anti-treaty IRA, evidently in solidarity with their allies who were being held captive in Kilkenny Barracks. After 3 hours of shooting at the house, the anti-treaty forces retired with no serious casualties on either side, we believe, although there was a large number of windows broken in the house. Either way, Woodstock House only had 2 months left to live, so to speak. On Thursday afternoon, the 4th of May, to the surprise of many, the pro-treaty and anti-treaty leaders reached a truce agreement in the Mansion House in Dublin. The deal called for a ceasefire for a number of days, with the hope of discovering a basis for army reunification, which they were trying to do. This meant the IRA reunifying. From the perspective of what happened after, it was perhaps wishful thinking, but it showed that not all hope was yet lost. In addition, the agreement permitted the anti-treaty IRA in Kilkenny to retain control of one of the local RIC barracks. Representatives of the Free States and anti-treaty forces, including local TD, Lieutenant General Garrod O'Sullivan, Brigade General Sean Mylan, who was also a TD, and Commandant Dan Breen, all arrived in Kilkenny on Thursday night by motor car. They met the local leaders of both camps in the badly damaged Imperial Hotel on the Parade and Rosine Streets, where they informed them of the truce agreement. The delegation then travelled to Hayden's public house in Callan to meet Seamus Robinson, who stood down the anti-treaty forces there. Meanwhile, back in Kilkenny Military Barracks, which is now acting as a makeshift prison, six prisoners escaped by scaling the wall. It probably didn't help that some of the sentries on duty had been on shift for 48 hours without a rest. Shots were fired at the escapees, which scared the inhabitants of Kilkenny once again, who thought another battle was about to break out. Five of the six prisoners were recaptured and brought back to the barracks. Prowse said that he had allowed prisoners liberal treatment up to now, but as a result of the escape, they would be kept under closer confinement with less privileges. However, as a result of the agreement arranged between the two sides, it was decided to release all prisoners. So, on Saturday evening, that's the 6th of May, just 3 days after the surrender of the castle, all 108 anti-treaty IRA prisoners, or should we say 107 minus the one escapee, were unconditionally released. Led by a man who played a mandolin, they marched from the military barracks in formation, led by their officers Richard Brennan and Dan O'Neill, to CC Hall on High Street, where they fell out and retired to various restaurants for refreshments and where they were greeted by their families. The peace agreement had a desired effect, as it diffused the situation throughout the county. The large party of anti-treaty IRA soldiers mustering in Callan dispersed and returned to their homes by motor lorries. Most of their transport, by the way, had been taken from Clonmel Barracks some months earlier, before the departure of Crown Forces. In addition, most proclamations issued in County Kilkenny in May and June 1922 were jointly signed by Commandant Prout, representing the pro-treaty side, and Kilkenny Brigade anti-treaty OC Eamon Elward, Ned Elward, representing the anti-treaty side. For the most part, the ceasefire arrangement lasted longer than the intended period of a few days and was superseded 2 weeks later by a political pact deal between Collins and De Valera, which lasted until the June elections. After all the fighting, Commandant Prout stated that the men he commanded during the 2 day Battle of Kilkenny were the best men he ever commanded, and he had charge of 800 men in France during the First World War. High praise indeed. After the conclusion of a remarkably eventful week in Kilkenny, it was not all positive news for Prowse. He received an unsigned letter from Kilkenny's true Republicans, in which the author or authors made their feelings crystal clear. Quote, "Dear Prout, the traitor, just a line to say I must congratulate you on a paltry victory of cowardice you and Big George Dwyer, the ploughman, showed in taking 2 days to capture 15 men. I may inform you that there is a few 45 Webleys isled waiting for you, your brat of a son, and Big George the coward. And Prowse, I promise you, sooner or later you will fall. You are marked. The black and tan stunt you did not work, you white-livered coward. But some day soon you will be done in, and Big George the ploughman." End quote. And I should say that kind of poisonous letters were something that was quite common in general in Ireland, then kind of the trolling of their day. Prout obviously, though, did not take the threats seriously, as he read the letter out in jest to his assembled troops in the days after the battle. He also made light to the danger of his 12-year-old son Jack, who was an accomplished shooter, commenting, quote, "The threat to murder my son I disregard, for he is able to protect himself." End quote. But one could say that the heart-hitting words of the letter were an omen of the animosity to come. Prowse would, though, live to fight another day. He was to the fore during the summer campaign by the Free States to dislodge the anti-treaty in Waterford and South Tipperary. Indeed, he went on to live till 1969 with a very eventful life in between, passing away at 89 years old. His son, that's Jack, lived until 1988. George Dwyer, his vice commander in Kilkenny during the battle, moved into the Guards 2 weeks after the Battle of Kilkenny and took charge of the barracks in Newbridge at the beginning of the Civil War, protecting it from attack. He spent the next 2 decades in the Guards and rose to the rank of Chief Superintendent. He retired in 1944. He didn't get long to enjoy his retirement and he passed away in 1948 at 44 Harcourt Street in Dublin, aged just 62 years. He'd been suffering from heart failure. Dick Brennan, that's the commander in the castle. Upon its surrender, joined the Flying Column during the Civil War. Indeed, South Kilkenny saw much more action than it had during the War of Independence. Like many anti-treaty soldiers, he moved to the US in the 1920s for lack of work and died in New York in 1966. Now, maybe just to give you an example of how one member of the general public felt about events in Kilkenny and the general political situation, I'll read out this correspondence that was sent to the letters to the editor section of the Irish Independent and printed on Friday the 6th of May, just a few days after the capture of the castle. It is likely this man spoke for a few. Quote, "Sir, the account of the fighting between brother Irishmen in Kilkenny is deplorable reading. Fortunately, there has not so far been any report of fatalities on either side, although a number of men appear to have been seriously wounded. We read after the surrender of Ormond Castle, a spirit of friendliness was displayed between captors and captives. What a shocking thing it is that while national leaders on both sides were firing talk at each other in the Dáil, the soldiers of Ireland, disheartened and bewildered by endless discussions, documents, conferences, pacts, interpretations, etc., were actually engaged in a deadly conflict, not with a foreign enemy, but with each other. Now, if instead of one section of the Irish army occupying Ormond Castle and another attacking it, they instead had combined forces and marched on university buildings with a Dáil assisting, they might have been more profitably employed. If they then surrounded that building when the members of the Dáil had assembled and sent in a notice that no one would be allowed to leave it until agreement, both on the great political question and on the army differences, had been arrived at, they would have deserved the gratitude of the Irish people. The Kilkenny conflict excites mingled pity and anger. When will honest men on both sides realise that the present conditions cannot be allowed to continue? Can there not be found a dozen clear-headed and patriotic men who can make our country something better than a laughingstock for our enemies and a heartbreak for our friends? Signed, Close the Ranks, Dublin." End quote. Now, his name wasn't printed for obvious reasons, but unfortunately for him and for everyone else, things would get worse before they got better. Just to conclude now, if I can, considering the thousands of rounds of ammunition that were expended from both sides over the course of the two-day Battle of Kilkenny, perhaps the most remarkable thing of all was that nobody was killed. It was a minor miracle if ever there was one. If many people had died, it is likely there would have been a far different narrative to this story, which could have sparked an escalation of the conflict nationwide. I would argue, maybe some wouldn't agree with me, that both sides were winners in the Battle of Kilkenny. Firstly, Commandant Prout was quite remarkable in the speed and efficiency in which his troops removed the anti-treaty forces from their various positions. Yes, he had superior numbers and ammunition, but as history has shown us, even a small number of people based in an urban environment who are barricaded well inside buildings are very difficult to remove. The 1916 Rising is a case in point, with the Crown forces having to resort to artillery to do the trick of ousting them. Shelling was something Prout did not do in Kilkenny, and for that we should all be thankful. Indeed, James Connolly was said to have been inspired by the siege of Sydney Street in London in 1911, when it took the combined forces of the police and army to supplant two Latvian men who were barricading the buildings there. So it was no easy thing, and the ground assaults and getting into the buildings were both essential and very brave. It would also be interesting to know what guidance Prout took, if any, from Free State GHQ. Did he launch the offensive off his own bat? He had to order the first shots to be fired upon fellow Irishmen in County Kilkenny. Now, in Dublin, for instance, in April 1922, along with the four courts, which everyone knows about, the anti-treaty soldiers also took over other buildings, such as Freemasons Hall and the Kildare Street Club, for example, and they were not forcibly removed from these places until June. So why was Kilkenny different? Was it Commandant Prout's suggestion, or perhaps it was because the anti-treaty had taken over people's private homes? If it had gone wrong and there was something of a massacre on either side, who would take the blame? It's just a toss. So how were the anti-treaty IRA in Kilkenny also victors in this battle? which of course saw them surrender all their garrisons. Well, the fact that no civilians or Free State soldiers were killed likely increased empathy for the anti-treaty side, at least in the immediate term, as can be seen by the reaction on the parade directly in the aftermath of the surrender of the castle. They were seen by some as the underdogs who had fought gallantly and bravely. They were up against a much superior armed force. In addition, many of those Kilkenny men fighting would not have had much experience of real fighting in the War of Independence. This was a huge learning experience for them, which no doubt helped the anti-treaty side during the Civil War. To use a hurling reference, no amount of training can compare to a full-blooded championship game. And this rings true here in regards to soldiers having a real battle on their hands and not just learning it from a textbook or in training. Similarly, without a doubt, the Battle of Kilkenny must have united and bonded these men. Even taking, for example, the 15 arrested in Kilkenny Castle, the majority of these men would not have been acquainted beforehand. Indeed, it's probable many of the anti-treaty were fighting alongside men they had just been introduced to. Fighting side by side and then being arrested and spending some days in prison together no doubt fostered a spirit of camaraderie and opened up connections to men from different parts of the county and beyond. So in other words, the experience bonded them and gave them a preparation for the battles ahead. Relationships wouldn't always be harmonious, of course, but it did accelerate the anti-treatyites' reorganisation locally. They may have lost this battle, but they had not lost the war just yet. It is then probably no coincidence that County Kilkenny was much more active during the Civil War, with more fighting and more casualties for that matter, than had ever been the case during the War of Independence. Taking all that into account, maybe, just maybe, Kilkenny saved itself from an infamous reference in the history books as the birthplace of the Irish Civil War in 1922. Prout's quick dislodging of the anti-treaty IRA in the city meant the hundreds of anti-treaty reinforcements mustering down in Callan, which included Tipperary IRA men, never really got a chance to head up to the battle in Kilkenny. Kilkenny City had survived relatively unscathed from the battle, and civil war had been contained, for the time being at least. And I think that's where we leave it there today, just to thank you all once again for listening, and don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the brilliant free resources. Until next time, thanks for listening.